Blog Talk Radio.
Full Fill Radio, a voice you can trust. Broadcasting live presents Two Guys and a Bible with Don Preston and William Bell. Join us each week at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central as we bring you exciting, sound, challenging, and comforting messages regarding the end times. Thank you for tuning in today. Don Preston is the founder of Preterist Research Institute, or PRI. Don is a prolific author, having written and published 19 books, a host of audio and DVD studies, and is a debater and defender of the full preterist view. His websites are BibleProphecy.com, Eschatology.org, and DonKPreston.com. William Bell is the founder of AllThingsFulfilled.com Ministries and has a website bearing the same name, and has authored 3 books, audios, and DVDs. He has published hundreds of articles and recordings. And now, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Two Guys and a Bible broadcast with Don Preston and William Bell.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is William Bell. Welcome to Two Guys and a Bible right here on Fulfill Radio, a voice that you can trust. We are in the holiday season. It's peak for people at places like FedEx and UPS and the U.S. Postal System. And, of course, if you got things being shipped in the mail, make sure you label them properly so you can get them on time. That's one of the biggest issues with shipping packages. People really don't put their mailing labels on good enough, and they just sometimes rely on the sticker. But if they write that address on the box, if anything becomes detached, then they're good to go. I learned that after having spent 13 years working in that industry, and it's one that I pass on to people. At any rate, we hope that you have a happy holiday season. Welcome to Two Guys in the Bible. Don, how are you today?
Well, I'm very well, William. Very well indeed. Been a great, great day. Had a marvelous study this morning with a member of my community here, a somewhat prominent member of my community here, I might add. And this is the third study that we've had. And of course, he wanted to study 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and been going through there. Today we spent a good deal of time developing and exploring the concept of the death of Adam. I made the comment early in our study that the story of eschatology was the restoration of what was lost, and that Jesus was not going to come to fix what was not broken. And that got him to thinking almost immediately. He said, well, yeah, that makes sense. And so when we began to explore Adam, where he was created, i.e. outside the garden, and we walked through just some of the really plain statements of Scripture, but even though the statements are really kind of plain due to tradition, due to prejudice, due to presuppositional concepts, people just simply overlooked them. And he even made that comment that it's right there. It's, you know, that's what the text says. And anyway, we've been studying for almost 2 hours, and he asked me a few questions. I gave him the scriptures to read. We made a few comments, and he just leaned back in his chair, and he said to a friend who was there participating in the studies as well, who attends the congregation where this minister preaches, and he said, I just got to tell you, this is real, what real Bible study is. He said, this is absolutely fantastic. And we'd been at it almost two hours. Well, I had to leave, and he had to leave, but he said, I don't want to leave. I don't want to stop. So it's so thrilling, so exciting to be a part of studies like that, and to encounter people who, number one, are well-read, who are themselves very, very knowledgeable. And yet they are full of questions, and they're willing to learn. He has said over and over several times that there it is, right on the page, that for the very first time in his life, he is seeing what the text actually says instead of just glossing over it or reading into it or twisting it around to say what he had been taught. And he said, I don't know when I have been so excited about studying the Bible. He said, this is just absolutely fantastic. So like I said, it's wonderful. It's thrilling to be a part of the studies with this fella and to know his questions, to see his interests, and to see that, to use the old term, he just a sponge, and he's just eating it up.
Well, that's great. It's always good to hear about these studies that are fruitful and that produce results, people's minds open, you engage in true dialogue, and you make progress along the way. And the outcome for that, for future prospects, is just fantastic. So to think that, you know, this kind of study is going on and leading to some opportunities that could be, you know, that could open some doors in the future because of who the people are, you know, their influence, their ability to reach many people, and then to have an open and honest heart to accept those things as they are going through them, and then to have someone of his, you know, intellectual capacity that is able to understand the arguments, know when he's made a good one or a bad one, as you say, you know, as you go along. That helps a lot when you're having these kind of discussions.
Oh boy, does it ever!
yes, it does. And so that's very exciting and just inspiring to hear that these studies have gone so well for you in, you know, with this gentleman. And I understand that you have an opportunity that didn't materialize, but that you have another door open and of opportunity in the future with another situation. So.
That's exactly right. I can't give any names. I can't give any details at this point. But on the 11th, which is on Thursday, I am actually due to have we have it scheduled right now for a 2.5-hour study with the president of a theological seminary. And he has actually expressed interest. A friend of mine has studied with him, sit down with him on two different occasions now, pardon me, sharing some concepts of covenant eschatology. He has reportedly said, I could actually accept covenant eschatology, called it preterism, if I could get the proper biblical answers on 1 Corinthians 15, Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians 4, as well as Acts chapter 1. And he said, I want to know what the preterist explanation of these texts, I want to know what the explanation is. And he said, I'm willing to listen. I'm willing to learn. So we've actually had two different appointments set up. Different things happened on both of those occasions. He is, after all, the president of a theological seminary, very, very busy. Other things interfered with me. But we do have that scheduled right now for this upcoming Thursday. And needless to say, I am super, super excited about this. would that ever cause reverberations were he to say, okay, I believe this, now what do I do? And believe me, I don't expect that to happen overnight. Just like my studies with this minister here locally, I certainly do not expect him to get in the pulpit next Sunday and say, okay, guys, guess what? I've got an announcement to make. Don't expect that at all. But I can tell you this, that this minister is a truly excellent public speaker. I have listened to him on the internet. And he communicates very, very effectively. He communicates powerfully. And he is a really, really good exegetical preacher. After I listened to him for the very first time, I came home and I told my wife, I said, this guy is just flat good. I thoroughly enjoyed listening to him. So, yeah, that's exciting. But, again, I don't expect this to transpire overnight. I don't expect him to make that radical move. I expect him to follow the principles of Jesus with his own disciples. In John chapter 16, Jesus told his own disciples, and here he is immediately before his own death, but he said, I have many things to say to you, but you're not yet able to bear them. And so they had to learn. They had to grow. They had to be able to comprehend the things that were about to happen before they were ready to learn even more from him. And that's the way we are as human beings. Very seldom are human beings able to take, the full truckload. I've encountered a few people like that, but by and large, people have to learn. They have to learn about hermeneutic. They have to learn about apocalyptic literature. They have to learn about time statements. They have to learn about the passing of the covenant, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes they will grasp one text. They will grab hold of that. They will learn that. They will cogitate on it. And they think, okay, that's as far as I'm going. And it may be as far as they go for a while until all of a sudden they see a correlation between that text and another text. And I know that I tried for a long, long, long time to try to hang on to 1 Corinthians 15, Romans chapter 8. And that's in spite of the fact that I saw 2 Peter chapter 3 as AD 70. And I'll never forget one occasion that I was sharing with a good friend of mine, and I was sharing some concepts from 2 Peter chapter 3, and he saw it immediately. And then he said, well, Don, that means the Lord's already come. I said, no, wait a minute. You know, we got 1 Corinthians 15, and we got Romans chapter 8. And he said, no. If 2 Peter 3 was AD 70, he said, you can talk all you want. But he said, if 2 Peter 3 is AD 70, then 1 Corinthians 15 and Romans 8 is AD 70. And I was like, I didn't want to go there. But the force of what he was saying was pretty clear. So anyway, exciting things are happening. I mean, absolutely exciting things are happening. You know, William, day before yesterday, I was sharing with this minister this morning. Day before yesterday, before noon, I corresponded with people, with ministers and with believers in India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Kenya, and Zimbabwe, all in one morning.
That's awesome.
It really is. It blows your mind. And every single one of those individuals were contacts from YouTube and Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Who have been watching and listening to the YouTubes. They are convinced. They're trying to share covenant eschatology with people in their country. One individual, he is from Zimbabwe. He is the very first individual that I've ever corresponded with from Zimbabwe. He corresponded with me by email, which is really kind of unusual for a lot of foreign countries. But he didn't even contact me through Facebook. He contacted me through email, wanted to know how to order a bunch of books. In fact, he wanted to order $300 worth of books. And I want to tell you, for someone from Africa or India or Pakistan or wherever to actually want to pay for the material, that's really, really, really unusual. But this man said, this is so exciting. And, folks, I know we're not into the text so far tonight, but many of you express a great deal of interest in news and appreciation for when we share with you what's going on in the preterist movement. Here's a guy who said that he had been watching the YouTube videos, and he said, I have been a very devout dispensationalist all of my life. He said, I've preached it, I've taught it, and he said, I thoroughly embrace it. But he said, I have been watching your YouTubes now. I've been going back through the archives, watching them very faithfully. And he said, I must confess to you that now dispensationalism seems to me nothing more than science fiction. He said that's all it seems, and it seems like bad science fiction. In stark contrast to the calm, to the sane, to the logical presentation and exegesis of Scripture that you are presenting on YouTube. And he said, I just want to express my profound appreciation to your solid, sound Bible teaching. He said, it has changed my life. And it's like, wow.
I think that's one of the best definitions of dispensationalism I've heard. So I think that's really good that, you know, it's having that kind of response and people have access to it, you know, around the world. And that, you know, it's people who are courageous and hopefully influencers who can take it and leverage it, you know, by sharing it with those around them so that, you know, you get even more from the effort and the seed that's being planted. So, fantastic job.
Well, it's just it's thrilling, and it's such an honor to be able to share, and for people to express that appreciation. It's really more than humbling when you hear from people like that. And I mean, it's just like I said day before yesterday, I communicated with people from five different countries before noon, all of whom expressed that very kind of sentiment. Just one more very quick example. One guy that communicates with me very, very often on Facebook. He is a minister. He has a Facebook page, not just for himself, but for his ministry. And he had requested of me some materials on 1 Corinthians 15. Well, William, I sent him a copy of the sit-down dialogic exchange that you and I had on 1 Corinthians 15 and the resurrection some years ago. If you'll remember that, you and I did that how many years ago? So I sent that to him, and he responded, and finally after he got it, and he said, this is exactly what I needed. I followed that up and sent him an article that I had written on setting the proper context for understanding 1 Corinthians 15, and I went into detail with an examination of the little apocalypse. And yes, folks, we are going to get back to that. But nonetheless, I sent him that article going into detail in the little apocalypse as well as Hosea 13. And so he wrote back and said, this is exactly what I need. And he said, I'm going to be sharing this with preachers and with college professors and with lawyers over the next several days. He said, I have access to several very, very prominent people in my country. And he said, I will be sharing this information with them. Well, since then, he has gotten back to me and said that some of those individuals are excited about what they're learning. And wow, you know, really, really cool stuff. Really cool stuff.
Oh, very good.
Well,
very
William,
good.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
William, at the request of one of our regular listeners, Rod Rupert from Springfield, Missouri, we've been taking a look at Luke chapter 17 because we had referred to it and gone into it just a little bit. And so we've been spending a couple of weeks on this. I don't know what you did with it last week, and I want to thank you for filling in my part. Last week, I had to take my wife to the doctor in Oklahoma City and didn't get back until, I think, 6:45, if I'm not mistaken, something like that. But be that as it may, I always appreciate your willingness to fill in situations like that. But, pardon me.
Well,
go ahead.
Appreciate
go ahead.
The opportunity as well. You know, I understand that from time to time we both get busy and that we just simply can't make it, but that's what having a team is all about, you know, where you can pull the slack. Otherwise, I didn't necessarily teach on Luke 17, nor on the subject we're going to talk about tonight. I actually did some work on 2 Corinthians 5 as sort of introductory foundation work, you know, to sort of continue to build on that resurrection foundation. But, you know, as that goes, by the time you get it halfway introduced, the time is gone. And that's kind of what happened last week.
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, after all, when I'm gone, it actually allows you to talk. I have a tendency, as you well know, I have a tendency to kind of get rolling, and next thing you know, I've been talking for 5-10 minutes, and you've been sitting there listening the whole time.
It's all right with me. I'm actually kind of nursing a cold here. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice, but, you know, I got that.
I can a little bit, yeah.
Congestion all in my chest, and so my head's not quite clear, but I'm here, and I'm going to do the very best that I can, but, you know, just carry on.
Well, I thought that we would continue with the topic of Luke chapter 17, but that actually goes into chapter 18. And I well remember, William, in my studies years and years ago, of how Luke chapter 18 was really, really shocking to me. I must confess that I had glossed right over it. And not only had I glossed over it, I had failed to see the connection with chapter 17. Jesus, as we suggested in one of our earlier presentations on Luke chapter 17, he warned the disciples that the days were coming in which they would desire to see one of the days of the Son of Man, which I believe means that they would desire to see one of the days of peace and prosperity and without persecution of the time they spent with Jesus for the majority of his 3.5-year ministry. But they would not see that. And the reason being is that not only was Jesus going to suffer in that generation, Luke 17:25, pardon me, but they were going to suffer with him. They were going to suffer like him. And so once I saw that when Jesus said, the days are coming in which you will desire to see that one of the days of the Son of Man, but you will not see it, when I saw that that was a prediction of persecution, all of a sudden it opened up chapter 18 to my understanding. And here's the connection. Jesus does not change subjects. I know that it says, and he spake a parable unto them to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint, saying, and he tells the story of the importunate widow, as she is called, the woman that wouldn't give up, is another way to put it. But there is a direct thematic connection in that Jesus has warned them of these days of persecution that are coming, this time of war, of conflict, of death and destruction that is coming. Therefore, they ought to pray to the Lord of hosts. And he illustrated that by the parable that he told. He is not changing subjects. He is not saying, okay, now I'm through with my discussion of the day of the revelation of the Son of Man at all. He is continuing his prediction of the day in which the Son of Man would be revealed, but he is continuing his prediction of the events leading up to that day, days of persecution. Because of that coming persecution, they need to be people of prayer. Now, don't anybody misunderstand me to be saying that, okay, Jesus was speaking of that first century generation and the persecution that was coming, therefore we don't have any need for prayer. I'm not suggesting that by any stretch of the imagination. Pardon me. But given the reality and the ongoing need, the ongoing blessings, the ongoing efficacy of prayer does not negate the fact that Jesus is addressing a very specific historical circumstance in this particular parable. So he tells them this parable, and he said, there was in a city a judge that did not fear God, neither regarded man. We got some of those kind of judges right here in my own town, William, probably right there in your town as well. But he says, there was a widow in that city, and she came to him saying, avenge me of my adversary. And he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, though I do not fear God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. And the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge says. And in other words, Jesus is saying, I want you to learn from what that judge says. Shall not God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them? I tell you, he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, shall he find faith on the earth? Boy, this parable is just absolutely chock full of significance. First of all, once again, we have to notice the thematic connection with the previous discussion of the days leading up to the revelation of the Son of Man. And by the way, you know, we find that in a variety of different ways, and I started to develop that, but for time's sake, I've already looked, and we're almost half out of time for the program, so I'm not going to develop that anymore. But I want you to notice that he uses, in the parable, he uses a very important word, and that Greek word is ekdeikesis, translated as avenge. And I want to tell you what, folks, the word avenge in the New Testament is an incredibly important word. It is used over and over and over in eschatological text. 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, to you who are being troubled, rest with us when the Lord Jesus shall be revealed from heaven in flaming fire, bringing vengeance, a form of ekdeikesis, on those that do not know God and that do not obey the gospel. Revelation chapter 6, 9-11, the souls of the martyrs under the altar crying out, how long, O Lord, do you not avenge us on those that are on the earth? Notice, this is the very kind of prayer that Jesus is talking about for the living to pray in Luke chapter 18. Only here we have the depiction of, may I use the term, of those in the Hadean realm. I understand that under the altar is not technically Hades, but the point I'm trying to make is that we have the dead, the martyrs, crying out for vengeance, ekdeikesis. And that word is very, very critical. Notice also the prayer. Will not the Lord avenge his elect who cry out to him day and night? And then we find the prayer of the martyrs, how long, O Lord? You know, William, not long ago, I was having an email correspondence with a guy, and amazingly enough, he had never explored the theme of martyr vindication in the Bible. He had certainly never seen its significance for eschatological studies. He saw no connection between the vindication of the martyrs and the coming of the Lord, the second coming, judgment, resurrection, etc. And, I mean, I understand that ignorance because it took me years to tap into that motif and that theme and to see how incredibly important it is. But, William, you've heard me say on many, many occasions, I really believe, and I still believe this today, I really believe that there are a large number of people, even in the preterist movement, who do not fully grasp the centrality of the theme of martyr vindication to the entire story of eschatology, to the story of resurrection, for instance. They don't understand in the Hebraic view of things that when a person was oppressed, when a person was cut off from the presence of Yahweh because of transgressing the covenant, they were dead. And as a result of that, for them to be restored to the presence of God, to be restored to covenantal fidelity, and to be restored to covenantal blessings, what did that mean? It meant to be raised out of death. It meant to be raised from the dead. William, I sent you a quote Was that early this week, or was that last week?
Well, anyway. I think you sent it earlier last week.
Okay.
And you may have resent
well,
it,
anyway.
But you sent it last week.
Okay, folks, I sent William a quote from a very, very noted scholar. The name of the book that the quote is from is The Survivors of Israel, Mark Adam Elliott, is the name of the scholar. Widely, widely recognized, very prominent scholar. And he was talking about the centrality of covenant for our understanding of not only non-biblical Jewish writings, but most assuredly for the biblical writings. And he said, it may very well be that the failure to grasp the centrality and the significance and the foundational importance, and I'm not quoting here, I'm just simply giving the thrust of what he said. But he did say that the failure to recognize the centrality of covenant, even when the word covenant is not used in certain texts, but the failure to see covenant as the controlling central motif may very well be one of the greatest theological tragedies of all theological studies. And he said, as a prime example of that is the fact, is the use of the word life and death. He said, in Hebraic thought, the words life and death must be understood within a covenantal framework to refer to life as the blessings of the covenant and death as the loss of covenant blessings. And he said, we should not adopt the Grecian view that life is the existence of breathing. Now that, again, those are not his words. But he said, to the Hebraic way of thinking, life is far more than the Greek word zoe, which means, you know, sentient existence as a biological human being. It's the beating of a heart, the function of a brain. No, Mark Adam Elliott was saying, pardon me, that's not the Hebraic view of life. Life is to live in covenant relationship with God. That's profound stuff, folks. That's really, really profound stuff. Now, Mark Adam Elliott is not a preterist, you understand. It's just that he is expressing extremely well preterist thought. And it's preterist thought, it's biblical thought, that more and more people need to tap into. Well, something that Mark Adam Elliott could have said, he did not express it in the quote that I sent William. But what he could have said was, and this has been expressed by men such as N.T. Wright and R.T. France and others, and that is that when people were oppressed, when they were taken off into captivity, when they were downtrodden, when they were in captivity, they were very much biologically alive, but they were dead. There is a motif in the ancient Hebraic world that has been characterized as shame versus glory by scholars. And what they mean by that is when someone was humiliated by being defeated in war, when they were defeated in political conflict, when they were simply downtrodden in any way whatsoever, they were shamed, they were dead, they were considered dead. When and if they were vindicated through conquering their enemies, turning the tide of war, when their financial circumstances would be completely reversed, they would be vindicated, and by being vindicated, they were glorified. And they were raised from the dead. Now, we get a little bit of that in the story of the prodigal son. The prodigal son took his inheritance, went into a far country, Luke 15, and blew it, wound up in the pig pen. Now, folks, you got to catch the power of that and the story of Jesus talking to a Jewish audience. Obviously, they're thinking of a Jewish young man squandering his inheritance, winding up in a pig pen, and that means he's cut off. He is unclean. He is defiled. He's dead. Well, he comes to his senses. He goes back home. Before he ever reaches home, his father runs out to greet him, falls on his neck, hugs him and kisses him, calls to the servants and said, "Kill the fatted calf, put a robe on this young man, wash him up, because my son was dead, but now he's alive." Pardon me. Oh, pardon me. Excuse the sneeze.
No problem.
Well, that's Jewish. I'm sorry?
No, I was just saying no problem. I was going to just fill in if you had to step away for a second, but go ahead.
Well, that's just good Hebraic thought. They were dead. He was considered dead. He's very much biologically alive, but he was considered dead because he had cut himself off from his father and from his father's blessings. Well, once again, how long before you avenge me on my adversary? Luke chapter 18. Well, that avenging would be her adversary had wronged her in some way. To avenge her would be to turn the tables and to make right what had been wronged. And Jesus says, yes, will not God avenge his elect who cry out to him day and night? Well, his elect are being persecuted. What kind of persecution? Does it demand death? Does it demand death? Jesus in Matthew chapter 5, 9 and 10, blessed are you when you are persecuted and reviled for my name's sake. Blessed are men when men shall revile you and say all manner of evil against you falsely for my name's sake. People talking evil against his followers is persecution. Now, that's obviously not a, quote, physical persecution. That physical persecution could take the form of Hebrews chapter 10, 32 and following. You took joyfully the spoiling of your goods, knowing that you have within yourselves a greater inheritance, a heavenly inheritance laid up for you in the heaven. They were suffering the loss of their goods, but that's persecution. And so they were crying out for vindication, for vengeance on their adversaries. And it's so important to see this theme in Luke chapter 18 in regard to Jesus' teaching in Matthew chapter 23 that all of the blood, those who had actually shed blood, of all the righteous, all the way back to creation. How do we divorce Luke chapter 8 from that? And Jesus puts that vindication of his martyrs and the vengeance on the persecutors at his coming. Now, that's just astoundingly important, it seems to me. So, William, go ahead. You were going to say something a moment ago.
No. I was just going to basically just confirm what you were saying while you were, you know, taking your health break there. But you were pointing out that when they were separated, you know, from the Father, they were considered dead. It was like life in the covenant, or life in the Jewish covenant, was that relationship with God within the covenant. And when someone was outside of that, they were dead. And so it was all about covenantal life. And that's a concept that we, you know, should speak more about, should share with others even more so that they get it. Because, you know, the common, as you were saying, the common idea of life and death today in religious circles is, you know, has to do with biology and not with the relationship that one has with God. It's all about, you know, relationship. And the most beautiful statement I find in the Bible regarding that, it was the time that Moses was in the wilderness and God, you know, was about to, you know, discipline the rest of the nation. And Moses is there interceding on their behalf. And, you know, God, or Moses says to God concerning going to the land of Canaan, you know, the land that they had been promised, the land for which they were wandering in the wilderness, the land that he was protecting them from all the temptations to get to. When Moses contemplated that God had separated himself from the rest of the nation, he made the statement that if God's presence didn't go, he didn't want to go himself.
Yeah.
And Moses really got it. That's one of my favorite statements for showing that Moses really got being in a relationship with God. And so the covenant aspect of life and death is very important. So you're doing a great job on that.
And there's some other terminology that we need to bring into this, which is extremely powerful. And I gave a presentation. I don't remember if you spoke at that seminar in Florida some years ago, William, or not, but I gave a lesson on dwelling before the face of God. And I will never forget the research that I did on that. I may forget some of the specific texts, you know, that I brought forth in that and that I researched on that. But folks, there are terms that are found throughout the entirety of the Old Testament. It begins all the way in Genesis, really, but you find it in the prophetic books especially. You find terminology like this that God, and well, we go back to the book of Numbers, for instance. Let me just start there. And Joshua, in giving the blessing to Israel, the Lord make his countenance to shine upon you. Well, the word countenance there and the word face that are used there are words that give you the idea of dwelling directly face-to-face with somebody. Well, Joshua was not saying, I want you right here, right now, to die and go to heaven and dwell in the face of the Lord. No, he was talking about, I want you to live your life in covenant fidelity in such a way that you dwell before the face of the Lord on earth. And a lot of people just don't get that. You know, they think we have to die and go to heaven to be in the presence of the Lord. Well, wait a minute. Wasn't Adam and Eve in the presence of the Lord on earth in time in biological bodies? Well, sure they were. There's no question about it. And by the way, the Jews looked upon the Garden of Eden as the most holy place. So when you look at it in that perspective, they were most assuredly in the presence of God. And this terminology, just the other day I was reading through Ezekiel chapters 34 all the way through 36, just spending some time there, just doing some casual reading. And it just struck me over and over and over how Israel had turned the back, not the face, unto God. As a result of Israel turning their back to him and not the face, he would turn his back on them and not his face. However, the time was coming in which he would bring them back from the nations to which he had scattered them, i.e. out of the Babylonian captivity, and they would dwell before his face. He would make his face to shine on them. He doesn't use the word shine, but that's the idea, the same identical idea found back there in the book of Numbers. And so this terminology, it's actually a terminology of intimacy. It's really interesting to me that the word face in the Hebrew, Greek translation of the Hebrew is prosopon. Well, prosopon literally means nose. So if you want to get really, really, really literal about the translation, I will cause you to dwell in front of my nose. Well, that really doesn't strike us as intimate, you know, Until we start thinking.
It strikes the Eskimos as intimate.
It strikes the Eskimos as very intimate. Good point. But the point of fact of it is, folks, it was that language was intended to convey covenantal intimacy, covenantal relationship, covenantal blessings. The Hebrews did not believe for a moment that you had to die and leave this world to dwell before the face of God, and they believed that in spite of the fact that the tabernacle was a constant reminder that they were separated from Yahweh because of sin. The veil was a constant reminder. They believed that there was an intimacy as a result of Torah that no one else had. Well, obviously, that's true. The Gentiles didn't have that intimacy. The Gentiles, the nations, did not have that closeness to God. So the tabernacle and the temple was a place of sanctuary for Israel, demonstrating that they were closer to God than anyone else, and yet they were still separated. But back to the main point, in spite of the fact that the veil was a constant reminder that they were not fully in the presence of God, it nonetheless said, you're dwelling before the face of the Lord. And that meant so much to them. So it just becomes so exciting and so thrilling when we consider the fact that when we are in Christ, we have entered the veil. Hebrews chapter 10, 17 and following, by him therefore let us enter into the veil, that through the veil, that is to say, his flesh. Let us draw near through the veil, through the body of Christ, by being in Christ. Let us draw near with confidence. You know, Hebrews chapter 4.
Don, let me interrupt you. We have a caller online.
Okay.
We can open the line to take a comment or a question.
Okay.
If you're ready.
Sure.
All right, hold on. Hello?
Yeah, I don't have one. Do you have one, Dad?
Excuse me?
I don't have a question.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought maybe you had a question. All right. Well, no problem. You can continue to listen. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. We appreciate that very much. So to pick up where I was, Hebrews chapter 4. pardon me. We do not have a high priest who cannot be touched with the feelings of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like we are, and yet without sin. Let us therefore, now notice the terminology, let us therefore come boldly before the throne of grace. Do what? Come boldly before the throne of grace? The idea that a writer was writing to Hebrews, telling them that because of the work of Christ, the high priestly work of Christ, they could now, with boldness and with confidence, come before the most holy place, the Ark of the Covenant, the mercy seat, which was on the Ark of the Covenant, and they could approach that throne with boldness. I can tell you, folks, there was not a high priest in the history of Israel that entered into the literal, physical, most holy place in boldness without fear, doing so with total confidence. They feared that place because, after all, if they haven't taken every single precaution to make sure that they are ceremonially clean, if they enter that place defiled, they're going to die. Now, by the way, the old story that the high priest put a rope around his waist in case he died in there so they could pull him out so nobody could go in. I've been reading some material on that says that's not actually true. pardon me. But even if it's not true, it doesn't negate the fact that they entered into the most holy place with fear. Because you don't go in there without purity, without holiness, without being cleansed. And thus the writer of Hebrews over and over, you know, talks about drawing near to God in confidence, having our conscience cleansed from dead works and our bodies washed with pure water. Now, the fact that he said our conscience cleansed is a direct contrast to the Old Covenant, because he says in chapter 10, the blood of bulls and goats can never take away sin, can never make the worshiper perfect in regard to conscience. It can never give them a clean conscience, in other words. So, I mean, there's so many contrasts in the book of Hebrews. And by the way, folks, pardon me, if you do not already have a copy of Tony Denton's book, From Flawed to Flawless, let me recommend that you purchase a copy of that book. You can purchase a copy on my websites, I don't think it's on my Don K. Preston site, but it is on my eschatology.org and my BibleProphecy.com. Tony does a great, great job in that book, From Flawed to Flawless, demonstrating the weakness, the fallacy, and the failure of the Old Covenant system, from the priesthood to the sacrifice, et cetera, to the perfect one-time-for-all-time sacrifice of Jesus Christ and the greater perfect tabernacle in which he serves as high priest, and in which we find cleansing from all uncleanness. So it's a great book. I highly recommend it. So go to my websites, eschatology.org or BibleProphecy.com, and order that book by Tony Denton entitled From Flawed to Flawless. You'll be really, really glad you did. It's great work. Pardon me. William? So what we're finding here, are all of these marvelous concepts of here Jesus calls upon them to pray to the Lord for vengeance. And this book of Hebrews talks about the different levels of persecution, which is why Jesus was encouraging his apostles that they ought always to pray in Luke chapter 18. To shift gears a little bit, well, before we do, I just have to point this out. The importance of the theme of martyr vindication is found in Revelation chapter 20, which everyone agrees is absolutely foundational to understanding to the doctrine of, quote, final salvation. Well, the millennium begins with vindication of the martyrs. It ends with the vindication of the martyrs. That thousand-year period, as it's called, in which the saints ruled and reigned with Christ, is the period of time in which the full measure of the martyrs would be filled up. Now, some people try to deny that. I'm having this written debate on Facebook right now with a guy that says, no, the only people resurrected in Revelation chapter 20 are the unrighteous. The righteous were resurrected in AD 70. Of course, he presented a real problem for himself. William, I don't know if you've got to read it or not, but he defines the resurrection strictly as biological death, and he says the resurrection of the righteous took place in AD 70, and the righteous have no part in the resurrection of the end of time. And as I pointed out in my last installment, that means that there is no resurrection for any of the righteous today. Period. I mean, if the only resurrection that is in the future is of the wicked, and if the resurrection of the righteous took place in the past, then you and I, no matter how righteous we might strive to be, guess what? We're not going to be resurrected. We can't have eternal life. What a horrible doctrine that is. And he says preterism is heresy. He says preterism destroys hope. My goodness gracious. So anyway, that's the kind of trouble people get in when they insist on physical resurrection. But my point is this. If we correlate Revelation chapter 20 with the vindication of the martyrs concept of Revelation chapter 6, Revelation chapter 12, Revelation 14, Revelation chapter 16, Revelation chapter 18, then the full vindication of the martyrs would come at the time of the final judgment, the end of the millennium. Well, if that be the case, Jesus said, all of the blood of all of the righteous shed on the earth all the way back to Abel would be vindicated at his coming in judgment in AD 70. That means the end of the millennium was in AD 70. And I've made this point in my debate with this gentleman, and my goodness gracious, he submitted his last and final affirmative today. Number one, he totally ignored the major thrust of my major arguments. And secondly, in trying to extricate from himself from his dilemma and trying to present his case, I read it and I reread it and I caught myself saying, what in the world did that man say? It is certainly one of the most confused and most confusing bits of attempted theology that you will ever, ever read in your life. I mean, I'm just literally astounded at how bad the presentation is. And, you know, William, you remember, pardon me, one pretty prominent member of the Church of Christ used to say, a very experienced debater, he used to say that the person that he hated to debate more than anyone else was someone who got up, just threw a whole lot of stuff out there, no rhyme, no reason, no logic, just threw a whole lot of mud on the wall, hoping something would stick, and would say, okay, disprove that. And this fellow used to say, disprove what? You didn't say anything. You didn't make a point. All you did was throw out a lot of words. And that was my impression from reading this fellow's last affirmative today. I was just literally shaking my head as I read that, going, I can't believe somebody actually believes this. It's such a convoluted mess of illogic. And I'm not trying to be unkind at all. I'm just simply saying it's an extremely difficult read. It's virtually impossible to comprehend. There are more unsubstantiated claims. I mean, he just throws a lot of stuff out there and says, well, Ezekiel, pardon me, Ezekiel teaches this with no exegesis, with no critical textual analysis. It's just like, you know, Ezekiel presents the following scenario, and he does not go deeply into the text to show what Ezekiel actually says. When he does go into the text, he ignores what Ezekiel is actually saying. He is as good a dispensationalist as I've ever seen. He inserts thousand-year gaps into the text where there's absolutely no indication of a gap whatsoever. But he says it's necessary for us to understand that there is a gap here. Well, it's only necessary if you have a preconceived idea. That's the only way that it's necessary to see a gap in any of the texts that he sets forth. Well, William, pardon me. My voice is failing me here for some reason. It looks like we're out of time. I want to thank everyone for joining us. We hope that our little discussion of Luke 17, Luke 18 has been helpful to you. We hope that you'll submit your questions to us. We appreciate all suggestions, and we'll get back to the little apocalypse very, very soon. In the meantime, I'm going to say good night. God bless. thanks for joining us on Two Guys in the Bible, a voice you can trust.
Thank you for joining the Two Guys in a Bible radio broadcast. On behalf of Dunn Preston and myself, we'd like to say, have a very pleasant day, and may God bless. Until next time, we'll see you on Fulfill Radio, a voice you can trust.